I have a friend in chemistry. We taught a class in religion, issues in science and religion together last interim. And I was trying to tell him the difference between teaching chemistry and religion years before that. And finally, when we finished the class, he said he thought he understood. Because in a chemistry class, we came in and said water was made out of hydrogen and oxygen. And somebody else said, no, I think it's made out of copper and banana peels. He had some good, clear tools for proceeding. And he wished it might be that way in religion, but it's really not. All sorts of views float around. And as we go back into trying to understand where those views come from, back into the biblical materials as source and norm, I think we have to get into those two things I've been trying to talk around during my time here. There's a variety of material within the biblical texts themselves. They don't all say the same things. There are different ideas going on there. And then to further complicate the matter, we'll come out with different understandings depending on what kind of tools or methodology or approach we use. I think it's very important for us, each individually, to be about the business of learning some things about those tools. Again, I think we jump too quickly into the text without really working through the methodology or presuppositions we're working out of. And they're always there, whether we place them on the surface or not. And as we began to try to come to grips with differences in approaches to and understandings of the Bible, I think it's important to deal with questions like these. Historically, what are the roots of these differences? I think looking at the material historically can give us some room and distance and freedom and new possibilities. And then other questions, what sort of supports are there for any particular view? Obviously, if we're going to go into looking at these different understandings of Christianity, they come from somewhere and somebody feels they have supports. But what are those supports? Because I don't think the supports for all the different understandings of the Bible are equally valid. Some, I think, simply come out of historical tensions and quite clearly gloss over what the author might be intending. So what are the supports for any particular view? And also, along with that, what are the implications? What are the implications of any particular view? I have some bibliography here, and I don't want to take time today to run down through it, but you can pass these around, and for those of you who haven't picked up a copy previously, some things there that I think would be of help. And particularly on a business of different approaches, Robert Grant's book, A Short History of the Interpretation of the Bible, is helpful. Okay, today and tomorrow I'd like to talk about creation. And I'd like to talk about creation, first of all, by taking one of my favorite creation texts out of the Bible. See if you recognize where it's from. It's kind of an unfair thing to do, but I like this passage very much. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you put him on a leash for your maidens? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay hands on him, think of the battle, you will not do it again. One of my own favorite biblical texts, a creation text, out of the book of Job, chapter 41. It draws on ancient mythologies, a mythology that's worked through in many different ways within the biblical materials themselves, as we see in this passage quite clearly. Who's the character there that's being discussed? Leviathan. Can you draw out Leviathan with the fish hook? Press down his tongue with the cord. You're going to put him on a leash and let your maidens play with him. Leviathan, what kind of, again, all sorts of different backgrounds, but Leviathan in the creation mythologies, who is he? What's his function? What's he about? Well, a very common recurrent structure in creation stories in the ancient world is like this. In the beginning, the earth is dark. It's covered with waters, the great primeval waters. In the primeval waters lives a terrible sea monster. He's called by different names in different cultures, Leviathan, Rahab, Tiamat. And the good God, whoever this may be in that particular culture, looks down and he says, that's a mess. The dark waters and Leviathan in them symbolize chaos and disorder and meaninglessness. Chaos, disorder, meaninglessness, evil is personified by this mythological creature, Leviathan. Okay, the creation story then, over and over again, biblical and non-biblical, is a story about someone's convictions that cosmos is possible in the face of chaos. Cosmos, a Greek word for order, meaning, purpose, and chaos, of course, disorder, meaninglessness, and death. So Leviathan personifies, embodies the great dark forces, evil, disorder, meaninglessness. And at this particular juncture in the book of Job, the author is simply making this kind of claim. There's an uncanniness and mystery to evil beyond man's control. Evil is not a problem, but a mystery beyond which man can what man can put into nice, neat packages and handle. And it's put in such a beautiful, poetic way. Can you catch Leviathan with the fishhook? You're going to make him one of your pets. So the reality and mystery of evil stand over against man, and this is a common concept then in creation theologies. And in the biblical creation theology, then, there are different understandings as to how and why cosmos, meaning, purpose, are possible in the face of the chaos. Okay? So creation stories, then, in one way and another, are ways of people spelling out their convictions that cosmos, meaning, is possible in the face of chaos, disorder, death, meaninglessness, and evil. from this basic structure, then, we go into looking at the creation theology in its different context with its different ideas, different perceptions about how and why cosmos, meaning, is possible in the face of disaster. The creation theology is very rich. We find it turning up not only in Genesis 1, 2, 3, but in that very beautiful passage there from the book of Job. Can you catch Leviathan with the fishhook? In creation psalms, like 104. In passages in the second Isaiah, Isaiah 40 and, to 55, in that section, creation motifs recur. Passage like this, I think 51 or 55th chapter, around in there, was it not thou that didst cut Rahab in pieces? Out of the Exodus, or out of the Babylonian captivity, the author is saying, rescue us, deliver us, do like you did in the beginning, chop up Rahab, deliver us from this evil. New Testament creation passages, for example, a favorite of mine again, the first chapter of Colossians, where creation and Christology, a kind of cosmic Christology, emerge. I'm always, over and over again, impressed by the profundity of particularly the creation theology in the Scripture. I'd like to go back now to Genesis 2 and 3, and I'd like to start with that one chronologically, and I'd like to end up my biblical studies with Genesis 1 tomorrow. Chronologically, Genesis 2 and 3 comes before Genesis 1. Commonly, scholars work with the idea, for a bunch of reasons we don't have time to get into, that four basic sources make up the Pentateuch. One of these sources, the Yahwistic source, comes from the 10th century B.C. The Yahwistic source is the source or background for the theology in Genesis 2 and 3. So in Genesis 2 and 3, we're working from a source, drawing on all sorts of old ideas, but a source that comes together in this creation story somewhere about 950. The creation story in Genesis 1 comes from another source in time. It comes from Genesis 1 comes from the priestly source, and the priestly source is formed down in the time of the captivity and following, somewhere between about 586 and about 450. Common sense will tell us the life situation of these people is going to shape the way they spell out their ideas as to how cosmos is possible. The historical situation in the time of Genesis 2 and 3, about 950 B.C., is the time of the Golden Age in Israel. Things are going well, the time of David and Solomon. The country is as big and powerful and prosperous as any time up until the present. Their borders are as secure as ever. They have lots of land and lots of people. And the Yahweh says we ought to be about the business of spreading the blessing. And by that he means taking the Yahwistic understanding of the human problems and of the divine solution to those human problems out to other peoples. At the center of the Iwistic theology is grace. I think a very difficult word to both to understand on the one hand intellectually, and a very difficult reality for us to attempt to live out of. But at the center of the understanding of how cosmos is possible for this ancient writer from 950 BC, Yahweh is a God of grace. Not a new idea that emerges with Jesus in the New Testament, but an idea we can trace, you know, back throughout the history of Old Testament. In Genesis 2 and 3, the author, I think, is working with basically two questions. One question is, why is man screwed up? Why is man fouled up? He doesn't seem to think it's necessary to convince people that he is. But he picks up with the question, what's wrong with man? And the other question he's working with is, how does God relate to man in his fouled upness? How does God relate to man in his fouled upness? And I think it's simply an amazingly profound story. As I go along here today, I want to say that I think that what Freud works with in the 20th century, as he works with the same problem, why is man in such a dilemma? What are the roots of the human crisis? And what the Yahwist is working with back 3,000 years ago is really very similar. I think that they come to some similar kinds of conclusions as to the nature of the roots of man's problems. They have different understandings, of course, as to how cosmos, meaning, might emerge out of the chaos. I think you're all familiar enough with the story, so we won't take the time to read down through it, but I'll just sketch through some of the ideas. It's an uncommonly artistic story. I think very carefully crafted. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, the second part of the fourth verse, on through 2:25, really builds a kind of platform. And on the basis of that platform, from 2:25 through the end of the third chapter, the author gets around to his main points. What's wrong with man? What are the roots of the human dilemma? And then secondly, how does God relate to man in this situation? We can get into the story a little bit this way. Where's Superman from? Anybody remember from comic book days? Superman comes from Krypton. Where is Adam from? Adam is of the earth. Adam is of the earth. There is a good bit of punning in the Bible. The word for Adam and the word for dirt, the same root. Adam is of the earth. He doesn't have to get back to Krypton. He's not a stranger here. He belongs here. This develops in the Iwistic theology, not only in this passage, but throughout, really in a kind of, you know, ancient ecological emphasis. Man is of the earth, he belongs here. Meaning is found here or not at all. For this author back in those days, there's no idea of resurrection and judgment. Meaning and fulfillment are on the earth or never. There's an old gospel hymn, and forgive my singing. I don't want to get adjusted to this world, I got a home that's so much better, I'm going to go to sooner or later. I don't want to get adjusted to this world. that's an old white gospel tune. But what's it saying? There is really a fairly negative view of life in this world. It's saying it's pretty screwed up, we got to go somewhere else. And that's put in kind of rough and tumble language there, but I think if we look through most any hymnal, we'll find the same kind of idea put in a more glossy kind of fashion. This is a pretty lousy place. We need to get away from it. Heaven, somewhere, some other time, some other place, on the other side of the grave, there can be meaning. But the Yahwist in ancient Israel doesn't think that way. He thinks radically in terms of problems and possibilities and fulfillment here on this earth. Okay, Adam is of the earth. Another thing about Adam, linguistically in the Hebrew, it's a generic term, not so much the label for a single individual as rather a reference to mankind as a whole. Okay, a very important kind of idea, or a very important kind of reality. Language, then, a tool for getting into the text. Adam, then, every man. The Adam and Eve story in Genesis 2 and 3, I'm arguing then an everyman story. Again, I wish we had the time to take a look at where we'd go with different tools, but I'm simply working with a typical historical critical understanding of the text. Adam is of the earth. Adam is everyman. Adam, mankind, Eve, mother of all living. Like a medieval everyman play. We are Adam and Eve. He is us. So I'm arguing then it's not the story of the first two people. I think to proceed that way gets us into, well, gets us away from the point of the text. Not the story of the first two people, but our story, us. We are Adam and Eve, freely and of our own accord. I think better than saying a story of original sin, a story of universal sin. A story of universal sin, of us and our common human dilemma. Okay, now I'm skipping over a bunch of things in the text, but moving up to the story of the garden and the prohibition. Adam and Eve are placed in the garden, and there is given them this one commandment or prohibition, however you want to word it. You can eat of all the trees of the garden except which tree? Knowledge of good and evil. Now this is really a curious kind of thing. A few years ago at Capitol at a baccalaureate sermon, someone from Battelle, one of the research institutes in the country, was preacher for the day. I don't know how come, but he took the text and told the graduating class that they had done the right thing. They had done, like it says in the Bible, they had spent 4 years getting a knowledge of good and evil. And, you know, that does some damage, I think, to what the author is talking about. But it's hard to really, you know, to take seriously what he's saying. He's saying, you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you surely die. A contrast, a choice, knowledge of good and evil versus life. And if we probe that, that really runs contrary to our rationalistic society as it's developed since the age of reason, industrial revolution, technological revolution, where we really think what we're all about is getting a hold of some sort of system of good and evil. Several things there with the commandment or prohibition. It's a link between God and man. I think if a parent never gives his child any guidelines, it means he doesn't take the child very seriously. But the Taoist is talking about a God who takes us seriously, who gives us structures, guidelines. These are amplified in this story and then throughout the Taoistic theology. For the Taoist, the structures or guidelines or laws are not punitive and limitations, but rather they're the boundaries of meaning. They're the boundaries of meaning. Life inside these boundaries has possibility. Life outside is chaos. The prohibition then a link between God and man, and at the same time a distinction. There are natural boundaries and artificial boundaries. Having to take 36 credits at Capital University is an artificial boundary, 36 credits to graduate. The red lights in a city are artificial boundaries. We have a whole bunch of artificial boundaries, but I would argue that there are also natural boundaries, boundaries that come with being born, boundaries that don't depend on my culture or my age or my IQ or whatever, but boundaries everybody's stuck with. And in a sense, I think to talk about God, to try to get into what we mean when we say the word God, is to try to sort out natural and artificial boundaries, to try to sort out natural and artificial boundaries. With the word God, I think we're trying, among other things, to point towards the natural boundaries everybody's stuck with. The Taoist has already mentioned one, according to his convictions. Man is interdependent with the earth. One natural boundary, man is interdependent with the earth. Adam isn't from Krypton. Looking ahead in the story, another of the natural boundaries, according to the Taoist convictions, Adam is lonely. You know George Bernard Shaw's story about this. Adam is lonely. Yahweh says, how do you like the animals? Play around with them, look them over, name them. And Shaw says, has Adam saying, what do I know about names? 2 days ago I was dust. And here he sticks me with all these animals. I dream up wild things. I don't know, you know, giraffe, tiger, what do I know? So the story goes along, and Adam is still incomplete. So we have the story of Eve out of Adam's rib. It's not an anti-feminist story. It may have become that in interpretations down through history. But it's a story like we find in most every culture, the story of the necessity of community. Man is man only in relation with other people. The basic community, that of man and woman. So another boundary then, another reality within which man must live to find meaning. One, interdependence with the earth. And secondly, interdependence with other people. Interdependence with other people. Now, I'm drawing on a particular kind of interpretation and on more of the Taoist theology, but I think he also thinks in terms of a third natural boundary everybody's stuck with, and that is our finitude. Our finitude. For the Yahwist, death is something that comes to all men, and when they die, they don't get resurrected and judged, but when they die, they go to the underworld storehouse of the dead. So death is a natural boundary, a reality everybody lives with. The death that Adam and Eve come to experience, I think, is to be understood more qualitatively than quantitatively. The death that comes as a consequence of falling out of the garden is a loss of meaning rather than a punishment for eating the wrong apple, so that because I ate the wrong apple, someday my cells run out. Not so much physical death then, but qualitative loss of meaning. You see what I'm saying there? Man is finite for the Yahwist. That's a boundary within which he lives. The punishment is loss of meaning, not physical death. Death understood qualitatively, not quantitatively. So it seems to me those are really important and interesting. He's saying there are natural boundaries, interdependence with the earth, with other people, finitude. Okay, so then the story goes on, and it picks up in Genesis 2:25, Adam and Eve are naked and not ashamed. And naked not like a centerfold of Playboy sort of thing, but rather, again, symbolically, as it's used over and over again throughout ancient culture. They're able to live openly and honestly without pretense. They're able to tell the truth with each other. But what happens? And we know the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Eve eats the wrong apple or pear or whatever. And what happens then? Things fall apart. Another way then, proceeding with what we've talked about, Adam and Eve step outside the boundaries. Or another way of saying it, Adam and Eve play God. Adam and Eve eat of the knowledge, tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, at this point, I'd like to take a couple of things to try to get into what I think the Yahwist is pointing towards there as the root causes of the human dilemma. One, Freud, and then two, a little thing from a little writing from a friend of mine, Ann Herbert. Okay, Freud also is trying to understand this. He says, you know, what's gone wrong? What's out of whack? What's wrong with man? And in a just a very quick, small summary, he says, as he tries throughout his life to try to figure out what's wrong, he comes down finally to this. He says, man is caught up between two instincts, a life wish and a death wish. On the one hand, he wants the joy and creativity and excitement of life. On the other hand, he wants some peace and quiet. And he says what we do is we opt for life. We see it dualistically, life against death, and we opt for life. But we opt for life on our own terms. We opt for life on our own terms. And we repress death. We stick it down and try to shove it away. But it doesn't go away. Rather, Freud talks about the return of the repressed, and he says death comes back to dominate everything we do. So life instinct, death instinct. We choose life, but life on our own terms. We repress death, but it doesn't go away. It returns to dominate everything we do. Again, some quick examples, one corporate and one individual, to point towards what this means. World War II, the Nazi actions in World War II, I think, are really, in a sense, insane. They really don't make sense. From von Clausewitz back around 1800 on up through, German military theoreticians, like theoreticians in other countries, have laid out all sorts of contingency plans. What happens if the French attack us, or if we think we need more land, or whatever? And by theory and by experiment with Bismarck, 1870, with World War I, back earlier in this century, they come to a whole bunch of conclusions. For example, one conclusion is we can't fight a two-front war. They told themselves that before World War I. Then they're at the gates of Paris, and somebody panics, and they switch seven divisions to the Battle of Tannenberg, and it's all downhill. So what does Hitler do to make sure there won't be a two-front war? Makes an alliance with Stalin. And what happens with the alliance with Stalin? The Russians don't threaten it, but Hitler breaks it. Now, this is really a weird thing. You know, theory and experience says you can't do that. But what's Nazism all about? The Thousand-Year Reich. We might not like to think of it like this, but Nazism, National Socialism, is a system of good and evil. We might find their goods not to our liking, but it is a system of good and evil. And on the basis of this system of good and evil, you make a thousand-year Reich. You guarantee life on your own terms. Okay? It's a system for securing and guaranteeing life will go the way you want it to. But then World War II, no two-front war, a pact with Stalin, Hitler breaks the pact with Stalin. And then, you know, one of the most scary, frightening, insane things, I think, in human history. In the middle of World War II, with all of their needs for carrying on a huge war like that, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but what the Nazis do then is to cart off 6 to 12 million people, build death camps, and exterminate those people. And think of it just from this angle for a while, what that takes in terms of resources. You could have used those people in your factories and farms, and you could have used them as cannon fodder in the front lines. It took people to kill those people. It took resources. One of the problems of Luftwaffe at the end of World War II is a lack of fuel. It took a lot of fuel to cart people to the death camps. World War II was not so much a defeat of the Nazis, but rather a kind of suicide, I think, a kind of worship of death, the sort of thing that Freud's talking about. When I try to run and guarantee the world on my own terms, the end result is that death sneaks around to dominate everything I do, the return of the repressed. And I think the ancient Yahwist is talking about really the same kind of things. When I try to play God, and I make my artificial boundaries like they were natural boundaries, and I try to force people within them, I try to secure and guarantee life on my own terms, things fall apart. One more example, an individual example, and it doesn't apply to any of us, but we all know people where it does apply. Like so. Jalin is a French anthropologist. He has a book entitled The White Piece. In that book, he's got some very interesting ideas. One idea is this. He says the basic model of relations in Western society is the model of Hebrew and Pharaoh. The model of Hebrew and Pharaoh. In every relationship, we seem to think it has to be somebody slave, somebody master. And we can see those problems again with other people. For example, in a teaching situation, it gets hard to break people out of wanting somebody to be Hebrew, somebody teacher to be Pharaoh, students to be Hebrew. And in individual, you know, like boy-girl relationships, I think we're forever about the business, or we have to work against the business of trying to set up that model of Hebrew and Pharaoh. I'll run things, you submit to my running of things. And so oftentimes relationships are contests over who will be Hebrew and Pharaoh. And we can get really sick in those contests. Freud says we divide up into, you know, sadistic, masochistic roles. We can like being Hebrew and we can like being Pharaoh, but it's kind of a nowhere sort of relationship. When we're caught up into that kind of contest, things fall apart. When we're trying to control the relationship on our own terms, the relationship self-destructs. Okay, and then I was saying, in addition to Freud and the Yahwist, I'd like to approach again from another angle, and I'd like to read a thing here of Ann Herbert's. And if nothing made sense so far, I think this will. It's a neat little passage. Some of you have heard it. I think Lee Elhart used it a week or so ago. In the beginning, God didn't make just two people. He made a bunch of us. Because he wanted us to have a lot of fun, and he said you can't really have fun unless there's a whole gang of you. He put us in Eden, which was a combination garden and playground and park, and he told us to have fun. At first we did have fun, just like he expected. We rolled down the hills, waded in the streams, climbed in the trees, swung on the vines, ran in the meadows, frolicked in the woods, hid in the forest, and acted silly. We laughed a lot. Then one day the snake told us that we weren't having real fun because we weren't keeping score. Back then we didn't know what score was. When he explained it, we still couldn't see the fun. But he said we should give an apple to the person who was best at all the games, and we'd never know who was best without keeping score. We could all see the fun of that, of course, because we were all sure we were best. It was different after that. We yelled a lot. We had to make up new scoring rules for most of the games. Others, like frolicking, we stopped playing because they were too hard to score. And by the time God found out what had happened, we were spending about 45 minutes a day actually playing, and the rest of the time working out scoring. It seems to me it ought to be such an apt description of what we do. Simply that one line. God was wroth about that, very, very wroth. And he said we couldn't use his garden anymore because we weren't having fun. We told him we were having lots of fun. He was just being narrow-minded because it wasn't exactly the kind of fun he originally thought of. He wouldn't listen. He kicked us out, and he said we couldn't come back until we stopped keeping score. To rub it in, to get our attention, he said, he told us we were all going to die, and our scores wouldn't mean anything anyway. He was wrong. My cumulative all-game score now is 16,548, and that means a lot to me. If I can raise it to 20,000 before I die, I'll know I've accomplished something. And even if I can't, my life has a great deal of meaning because I've taught my children to score high, and they'll be able to reach 20,000 or even 30,000. Really, it was life in the garden that didn't mean anything. Fun is great in its place, but without scoring, there's no reason for it. God actually has a very superficial view of life, and I'm certainly glad my children are being raised away from his influence. We were lucky. We're all very grateful to the snake. So, Adam and Eve eating the apple, falling into the business of keeping score. And such a profound story. It's back in ancient Israel where he can talk familiar about God. And he's had a hard day, apparently, and he's going to take a walk in the garden and cool off at night. And he's looking for Adam, and he says, "Where are you?" And almost the first thing Adam says is, "Eve did it." And he's just, a few lines before he said, man, in order to be man, has to have community. And here he's saying, when man starts scorekeeping, community is impossible. The community shatters, and we shatter on the basis of scorekeeping. So we condemn ourselves. We set up our system of good and evil, by way of which we're going to guarantee things will be all right. And a lot of our fragmentation and alienation from self comes because we aren't quite making it in our scorekeeping system. And we fragment and break off from other people because they don't play the game the way we want to. Or they're in a scorekeeping bracket that's different from our own, or whatever. Out of the scorekeeping, out of man trying to secure and guarantee life on his own terms, within his artificial boundaries, neglecting, ignoring the natural boundaries, life falls apart, community shatters. Eve did it. Such a profound story. I think so much insight. Then the second question the Taoist is dealing with, he's saying, convictional claims. He's saying, I think this is what it is. This is at the roots of the human dilemma. And then the second question, how does God relate to fouled up man? That beautiful little passage, Yahweh makes for Adam and Eve garments of skin and clothes them. The Taoist is really monotonous in his stories. Let's just check down through a few of them. Adam and Eve eat the wrong apple. Nonetheless, Yahweh clothes them. Cain kills Abel. And nonetheless what? Yahweh puts a mark of protection on Cain. We get things so tipped upside down. For example, in the movie The Bible, the mark is part of his punishment, but it's a mark of protection. Another Yahwistic story, Abraham goes down to Egypt and he says, look, Sarah, we can get along a lot better if you pretend you're my sister instead of my wife. And things get all tangled up and Yahweh rescues Abraham from Egypt. In story after story, he tells about the nevertheless, man's rage for chaos, and God's nevertheless, meaning is possible in spite of man's rejection of the natural boundaries, in spite of him playing God. But he's not an easy God, as the Taoist depicts him. Another Taoistic story, I'm saying the Taoist sees God as a God of grace, but grace doesn't mean cheap and easy. It seems to me so often, like Bonhoeffer talks about, grace becomes cheap grace. Forgiveness comes to me, and it doesn't make any difference what I do, God likes me anyway. But insofar as I live in a world of scorekeeping, I've chosen to be outside of grace. I've chosen to be outside of grace. I'm embraced by that grace, but I can be in flight from it. So in Genesis 32, another really neat Yahwistic story, the same author, the story of Jacob at the Jabbok. Jacob, you remember the stories of Jacob, what a bandit he is? In fact, one of the meanings given for his name is rascal, cheater. He cheats his brother out of the birthright, out of the blessing. He goes up to his uncle and he works for him. And he and his uncle cheat back and forth on each other. Finally, when he leaves his uncle, he steals the household gods, the deed to all the property. It remains to be seen whether he can hang on to it or not. But In essence, he steals everything from his brother and from his uncle. And he's caught between the rock and the hard place. The setting for the story, the Jabbok, a little stream over in the Transjordan. It's night, and he's gotten his wives and kids and flocks and so on across the river, and he's stuck on the wrong side. And here we see the freedom of the ancient author to take up and use old mythological ideas. He's on the wrong side of the river, and it's dark, and it's pretty scary because why? You don't, in those days, you don't drown because you get too much water in your lungs. You drown because the spirit power bags you. Okay? And sure enough, Jacob is attacked by one of the spirits who wrestles with him, struggles with him. The spirit is later identified. Israel, Peniel, God himself. It is God with whom he wrestles. And so this God of grace is not cheap and easy, but rather he is the God who throws us into conflicts, into struggles, to chase us away from our playing God back into the natural boundaries. So it's almost daybreak, and the spirit says, "Let me go. You know, I got to get out of here. It's light. I'll disappear in the sun." And Jacob says, "I won't let you go unless you bless me." And the spirit, God, says to him, "What's your name?" And he says, "Jacob," meaning cheater. And he says, "So you get a new name. Now you'll be called Israel." And Israel means what? Sure, some have run into this before. Literally, the one who wrestles with God. The one who wrestles with God. So this biblical God, this God of grace, is not, you know, the kindly grandfather, the living doll kind of thing, like Vahinian talks about, but rather he is a God of wrath and love, and the wrath and love are brought together. They are of one God. A God who is the ground of our being agitated. A God who is the ground of our being agitated. The hound of heaven, who chases us out of our phony answers to who are you. Augustine, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. And biblically, he seems to be the sort of God who's willing to chase us through a whole bunch of hell in order to chase us out of our phony answers. So God of grace doesn't mean cheap and easy. But rather the ground of our being agitated. I have to say this. There's one footnote on that story in Genesis 32. So Jacob gets a new name. No more Jacob, but Israel, the one who wrestles with God, a meaningful identity. And then he says to God, "What is your name?" And the conversation ends, "Why do you ask?" Like none of your business. It's not for you to control. My goodness, I have some time here, 3-4 minutes. What do you... Any things you want to check back over and talk about, or differences?
Carl, just out of my own curiosity, that telling and asking of the names, is that, I don't know where that concept comes from, but is that part of the concept of over your real name is opening yourself up to the person, or to the whoever?
Yeah.
So that Jacob telling his name opened him up to God, and God withholding his name withholds his mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. Name as identity, giving your name a laying bare of who you are. The biblical names a lot of times summarize what the person is all about. For example, Elijah in about 850, his name summarizes his whole ministry. It's his time of contrast between Baalism and Yahwism. And his name, Elijah, El is one of the big general words for God, and Elijah means literally, Yahweh is my God, not Baal.
Would you consider John, the first part of John, as part of the Genesis story too?
A creation kind of story? Yeah, I think the in the beginning was the Word and so on, and Colossians 1 are working with this, you know, similar kinds of ideas. I really don't know if anybody's done it, if maybe somebody else knows in here, but it'd be really interesting to take all the creation motifs and passages in the Bible and discuss them under one, you know, under one volume. But they're so many really, again, very beautiful and profound stories. Like the Job thing, evil is a mystery, not a problem. Yeah.
I think one of the things that struck me as you were talking about, part because I had to go over it again, but in my head, this death is not quality. It makes me want you to go on then and talk about death then in other scriptural
Yeah, like you were mentioning John, I think, you know, in my own opinion, I think quite clearly in John's gospel, the terms life and death are qualitative. You know, like we quote John 3:16, God so loved the world and so on. But as it continues, he says, he talks about having life already and being condemned already. Or Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven as, well, like in Luke, it's among you, it's within you. So the focus, I think, is on the quality of my being rather than on unending time. John's gospel would be a good place to pick up with it.
Another thing I've always been curious about in the Genesis story where when God decides to kick Adam and Eve out of the garden, he says it's because they have become like us, and if they now eat from the tree of life, they will live forever. And the Tower of Babel story also, where the writer seems to be saying that there is some fear involved almost on the part of God that the human beings will attain some level that the God doesn't want them to attain. Or is it the reverse of that? The writer saying we are trying to attain that but we have no right to.
Well, maybe like this, you know, the kind of world man would attain would be, I would think, a world, you know, a brave new world, 1984.